visitors can leave your website and see the larger web as really a component of your website. The differentiation in a visitor's mind is increasingly breaking down between, quote, your website and the web as a whole. The other side of that, though, is that the ability to deliver a presentation to the visitor, the ability to construct the page, if you will, that the visitor sees, the architectures for that are changing dramatically. And the notion of architectures for participation applies as much to the way you construct a website as to your visitor's ability to interact with it. One example of that is service-oriented architectures, outsourced solutions for components of your website. Another example of that, though, that doesn't quite fit into the notion of service-oriented architectures, is, for example, I think in 5 years ago, many sites migrated from the notion that they had to do everything in-house to outsourcing things like metrics. You can include that in your site without having to develop it yourself and without having to bring a box inside. The web infrastructure supports your constructing of your metrics as an extended web component. Well, that migration is going to accelerate dramatically into web-based interaction architectures for delivery of presentation, delivery of content to visitors.
Good. So basically, here is an example of only looking at implicit behavior, but doing it in a much richer modeling environment with much cleaner metrics and a much faster way of integrating than what we had before. Let's move from Bruce to Steve Levine, who is the CEO of a company called Transparency. And could I get my slide for a moment, please? Transparency now goes and says, let's also try to understand or give the user a chance to explicitly tell us what they are looking for, in this case here, when they're buying for a camera.
Sure, that's right. Thank you, Andreas. This example here that we're seeing, I think it's interesting, just as a segue, Bruce was talking about using implicit user data that's been collected. We're using explicit user data, and we're letting the user participate and tell us in very simple but highly accurate ways what they're interested in. This is a great example of what we do. Thank you for the slide, Andreas. What we're showing here are a couple of sliders that we have that let the user tell explicitly, here's what I care about. I care more about the price, the number of megapixels, the editor rate, as they do their search. And these sliders are written in something called AJAX. Maybe I should define AJAX for the audience. This is a new set of technologies or protocols that are letting people,
thank you,
that are letting people interact with the web browser as though it were an application, as though they actually had something there that they could play with on their computer, even though it's coming to them over the internet. And AJAX is allowing people to treat the data set in ways that allow them to really explore and discover things that they couldn't in the past. What we're doing with search is letting people, and this is just one example, I think you're going to see it not just with Transparency, but just in many different applications in the future, to search once and then to explore, to stretch the search in different ways using this AJAX that you've got on the front end. You're going to be seeing a lot of this in the future, I think, Andreas, as people start to use new architectures to explore the data, to participate with the data. And you're going to need new complex back-end systems that can support the ability to use AJAX to interact with the data set in a much more flexible way than they could in the past.
Good. So here we again see the centrality of the data which has been collected, but by being closer, but giving the user the freedom to actually access your back end. One demo which I recommend you play with is, if you're interested in buying diamonds, Amazon.com has an AJAX-y way of showing you, as you increase this and decrease this, what's left in the set in essentially real time. So that is a very, very different user experience and a very different way of the user to build a mental model compared to the Web 1.0 model of Google, where you click on a link and then you get transported there. That's what I mean by the traditional Google. Of course, Google also uses Ajax, for instance, Google Maps, for instance, Google Mail. Yahoo has a wonderful new mail interface which uses Ajax. So that's just really having that pipe open is the way, which is a huge difference between now and 10 years ago.
Sure, and I can elaborate on that. I mean, I think you're seeing all these people experimenting with these Ajax applications. Google Maps is a great example. Giving the user the ability to really play with what's on their screen in ways that you couldn't in the Web 1.0 model that we were talking about. In Web 1.0, if someone would search for something on an e-commerce site, it was a very slow process. As Andrea said, you know, I guess we started with the web that you couldn't write on very much. Then you could write on it, but you couldn't really find things quickly. You had to iterate and iterate in very slow, complex ways. By giving people tools like Google Maps to slide a map around, or like the sliders that we have in Transparency, these kinds of things give the user the ability to really find what they might want in an e-commerce catalog in ways that they could never have dreamed about 10 years ago, and people are just starting to figure out ways to work with users to help them explore the data set in similar ways.
Good. One very interesting thing in terms of how people make decisions is that we can now observe the process of decision making. There's a field called judgment decision making, for which Danny Kahneman got a Nobel Prize about 3 years ago, which shows the biases people have, biases as compared to how rational economic agents, and being here in Chicago, where the University of Chicago is one of the key places preaching that. But people don't behave that way. So what's really interesting is that by observing people just how they do things, we get much closer to understanding what they actually are looking for, and by answering some of the questions which we don't know the answer a priori. For instance, how complex a site should be. If you have 73 products that match the descriptions, should you just pick those 5 and hope that the user will make a decision? Or should we pick all 73 and then have him probably say, well, yeah, oh, that's very interesting. I'll get back to it some other time. Okay. Let's move on here to Manish Chandra. Manish Chandra is the CEO of a company called Kaboodle. And I would like to get the slide, please. Kaboodle goes one step beyond just asking people to show their preferences. And in some way, we could view it as a second generation tagging tool. I showed you Delicious, which was purchased by Yahoo, where you can just add a word to URL. But Manish felt that was not enough. So he created a tool which goes beyond that.
Sure, Andres. Just to kind of give you a second on tagging, I think tagging is not a new concept. How many of you have kind of taken a product catalog and said, you know what, this stuff will be good for my living room, this will be good for my daughter, this stuff would go well with the sofa I have. Every time you've done that, whether it is on the Sunday newspaper clippings that come from your retailer or from a product catalog that comes in the mail, you've tagged. Essentially, tagging is the process of saying, you know, how is this information relevant to me? So as you're doing that, when I'm shopping, whether I'm shopping online or offline, I'm always sort of taking mental notes. I'm going out there and saying, this dress is relevant for my daughter, this would be great for my prom, this would be something that would be great for Steve for his birthday. Imagine if you could capture all that data. And as you capture that data, you could almost dynamically redo your product catalog. So that instead of saying this sofa is a mahogany sofa with red fabric, you could say, you know what, this sofa would go well in a modern contemporary home, or this sofa would go well with this lamp I have out there, etc. Or, you know, this is the best iPod accessory for a product. And what is happening is with Web 2.0, users are actually going out on the web and telling opportunity is to capture that information, not just in a way that is useful for the user who's actually out there, but then expose it to all the other users who would benefit from it. So really what I call it is tapping into the virtue of selfishness when I'm actually out there expressing this for me. As a byproduct, I can tap into the virtue of selflessness. That is, I actually share and participate and express that for everyone else. So for example, if I'm out there, Andres, if you scroll down, you'll see a woman on our site who's out there just looking for clothes. So if you just click on that clothes tab, and she...
Are you sure it's appropriate?
It's fine. You won't find anything, even though that looks...
Because, note, we give up control.
Absolutely. And so she's out there collecting a lot of information, and she's out there expressing the different dimensions of this information, collecting it from across different retail sites. And as an implicit part of that, this page, which is collected, is then exposed to other users, and they can leverage it. So that becomes the virtue of selflessness out there. The final thing is, one of the challenges is making it so easy so that it is a natural process or part of how a customer tracks information. So instead of saying, you know, let me tag this thing as being relevant in X, Y, and Z ways, let me collect information for my wedding, for my home, for a gifting, for graduation. And as a byproduct, you get tags out there. And that's really the opportunity that Web2 gives you, is using your customers to help you redefine what you do and how you merchandise and how you approach the whole process.
And actually, it's not necessarily just your customers. It could be somebody else's customers.
Absolutely.
And it's really a shift from, you know, just viewing people as customers you send targeted ads to letting people discover. And I think you get a feeling here, and that's really something which I want to get across, how this pyramid is turning upside down. That if Amy Louie, or whatever her name is here, Stones, whatever, if she feels that something is interesting and to be compared with something else, it is up to the world. If Lawrence Lee feels, the guy I showed you before, who does the tagging on Delicious, that he finds something new, I can subscribe to his tags. And so the discovery process, that if I have people I think are cool, because they have time to hang out with other people who are cool, to find cool stuff, I can just subscribe to what they see and filter it in some way to see what I think otherwise would be very hard and would certainly not be happening in a newsletter by, let's say, an airline which tells me that you can fly from Chicago to Shanghai, but unfortunately, when I open it, of course, all seats are booked up. So what we have seen in Bruce's case, implicit data, web services. What we have seen in the second case is explicit data. What we have seen in the third case is using technology to actually grab pieces of information into the sites, in the sites here, and then being able to edit this and potentially have your own shared bookmarks. Ramit Sethi is with a company called PBWiki, which now takes the idea of having some text which you edit, but not only allowing you to edit it, but making that a global effort. Some of you might have heard about Wikipedia, which is a beautiful example of architecture of participation, where people who actually are experts and actually care for a certain topic contribute, but if you disagree with them, because you might be also an expert in that topic but have a different opinion, you can then edit the page they just made. For an example, how I use it at Stanford in the course I'm teaching is that I here have my course homepage, and there are some hits, some tips how people can actually use the Wikistyle page, and then they can here put their comments in each wiki for each class. So a wiki is the idea that many people can actually edit the same document. What used to be hard was to get the technology going on that. Now, we'll learn from you that it's not that hard anymore, but as easy as making a peanut butter sandwich. Is that right?
That's right. Thanks. The problem now is not the technology. The technology is there and it works. And you know, when we show DBWiki or anything to partners, a lot of times people ask us questions about who has access, who has control. And we say, no, that's not the problem. The problem is not control. The problem is getting people to participate in the first place. So removing those barriers is really, really important, whether it's making it easy, making it fit in the user's mental model, or just simplifying the form to get people started. So it's about simplicity, and it's about making it focused on the user. There's a couple other things from our experience in letting users collaborate, whether it's sharing documents and adding revisions, sharing recipes with their mom, whatever it may be. A couple things that we've learned, and one is that people really do want to talk about their life. They want to talk about themselves. They want to talk about what movie they saw last week. And we see evidence of this in the blogosphere, millions of blogs, evidence in social networks like Facebook, which has, about 80% of college users in the United States, and 90% of them log in once a day, which is a stunning number. People do want to talk about it, and often people are defined, at least in part, by the products that they use. So if you do a search for any of these products, you're going to find tons of blogs and tons of websites where people are actually talking about it. There's one more thing, which is control. And that's something, Andres, you talked about a bit today, giving up control. And I have to agree 100%. I mean, users are getting control. And the question is, do you want to be a part of that, or do you want to just let them take it away? I'll give you a couple of examples. If you do a search for many, many big companies on Google, you'll find in the top 5 hits, there are actually websites against these companies. So search for Delta, search for Best Buy. I think the third hit on that is BestBuySucks.com. And then there's tons and tons of companies. And they're participating, they're collaborating. So it's about, do you want to be part of that? You're going to give up control, and do you want to be part of that or not? There's one t-shirt company I know, Custom Ink, that actually puts live comments that are emailed to them directly on their website. So if you go there, you can actually see comments that say, your product sucks, or your product is great, I love it. And that is a huge credibility boost that makes them one of the most popular t-shirt sites on the internet.
Right, I think one thing you have to be aware of is with dozens of millions of customers having a voice, and with both static search engines such as Google looking for websites where that voice is posted, and having tempo-based search engines such as Technorati or Ice Rocket looking for comments in blogs, those issues are out there. So the question is whether you want to actually at least see them and increase the reputation you have and the trust customers have in you as a company, as a retailer, or whether you want to have it as a United Airlines example here I gave, as a second hit where people complain, and then it's not clear that United has a voice to correct things, saying, for instance, that out of 2,000 complaints sent to customer service, only something like 40 has been dealt with. So you give it out of your hand, or you can put it in house. And sharing is, I think, where the attention of people really gets focused, and you can create something you couldn't create otherwise.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's a recent auto company that gave users the tools to create ads about the product. And there's something really interesting about what happened. It was about SUVs, and some of the users created ads that said, SUVs suck. They take a lot of gas. Why would you buy it? Why would you destroy the environment? And that was part of it. The company actually, to its credit, stood up and said, hey, that's okay. We're willing to take that heat. Because they also had a lot of users that created great, very positive ads. And this was covered in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and a bunch of other places. They were willing to relinquish that control and see what happened with it. There was some bad. There was also a lot of good.
Or another story I have from China. I spend a couple of months a year in Shanghai and Beijing, where I teach executives. And they told me this story about two college boys from Shenzhen in Guangdong province who just made a 3-minute video lip-syncing a Backstreet Boys song. And within days, those two guys with their red sweaters were downloaded absolutely millions of times because it was a really funny movie. In response to that, a major soft drink manufacturer actually found those two guys and now moved that talent search to seeing what's being posted in homemade videos. In the United States, you might have heard of a company called YouTube.com. Every day, 30 million videos get viewed on YouTube. And every day, about 35,000 new videos get uploaded on YouTube. So that pushes us to the question again of discovery, and specifically of discovery in the long tail. What do you mean by long tail? Physical stores, like most of yours, are limited by shelf space. So if you are storing videos, you have to think very hard if you're a Blockbuster in a physical store. Which videos am I going to store such that I have a good chance of people actually renting those? But there's a very long tail, a big distribution of videos which some people might want to rent sometime, but it's not worth it for you to really store them every single day. So here are some pictures from a company called Netflix, where two things happen. Number one, by making recommendations, you create demand in the long tail. Remember, I before mentioned the shift from the push, the supply-driven economy, to the pull or the demand-driven economy. So here it turns out for Netflix that half of their sales, if you will, rentals, comes from titles which are beyond 1,150. That is effect number one. These are existing professionally produced videos, shifting there by offering the long tail. Add to this, or rather multiply with that, effect number two of user-created content of those two boys in Shenzhen, and you will see a dramatic shift in what people are buying. Our last panelist is Mike Shah. Many of you have a piece of Mike in your pocket because he used to run the co-branded credit card at Amazon.com. After that, he worked with Jeff Bezos in strategy and is here today to potentially first comment on the long tail thing at Amazon.com, because Amazon makes actually more than half of its revenues for items which are in the long tail.
Sure. I think backing up a little bit here, talking about demand generation, because the fact that online, you are in a situation where you have such a broad catalog of products that you can offer your customers. And in that situation, really, what you're trying to do is create relevancy so that you allow customers to discover what they're interested in. And it turns out that, at Amazon, an old colleague of mine said, there are more books today that are going to be sold at Amazon.